Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, January 22nd. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital's Oncology Program, a team approach to cancer care closer to home for the Saratoga community. SaratogaHospital.org for more information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Alan Sanders of Upstate Infectious Diseases Associates and Al Cardillo of the Home Care Association of New York State. They're here to answer your question about infectious disease and sepsis. We always get a lot of calls on the program, so get yours in now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday are Dr. Alan Sanders of Upstate Infectious Diseases Associates and Al Cardillo of the Home Care Association of New York State. They're here to answer your questions about infectious disease and sepsis. Dr. Sanders is the president of Upstate Infectious Disease Associates in Albany. He's the chief of infectious diseases at Albany Memorial Hospital, Saratoga Hospital, St. Peter's Hospital. Al Cardillo is the executive vice president of the Home Care Association of New York State, which is comprised of nearly 300 home care agencies, hospices, and managed long-term care plans. He's also the project director for the association's new Sepsis Intervention Initiative. Alan and Al, welcome from Alan. Thank you. Medical Monday.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're here. Thank you. Let's start out by going to Al Cardillo, who is going to talk to us about the new Sepsis Intervention Initiative. What is that, Al?
Thank you so much. This initiative of the Home Health Association is an effort to bring into the community level screening, education, and early recognition and intervention for sepsis cases. Sepsis is really a very, very broad and major problem across the United States and, of course, within New York State.
And what is it?
Sepsis is the body's overwhelming response, a dysregulated response to an infection. Sepsis is something that can advance very, very quickly and result in death within a very short period of time. In New York State, for example, there are about 50,000 cases of sepsis each year. One-third of them result in death. Nationally,
one-third of sepsis cases result in death.
In death, yes.
And how long before the
infection? Well, part of it, and that's the key point, part of it depends on how quickly the symptoms are recognized and an individual gets into treatment. It's very often perceived that sepsis is a problem that is a hospital-only problem or a problem that occurs in hospital. That's largely because the symptoms are not recognized either by the individual who's affected, a member of the family, or many times even a professional. By the time they feel so bad that they go to the emergency room, they are approaching either severe sepsis or septic shock.
And is there another name for sepsis?
I mean, septicemia. Sepsis is really what it's called.
Dr. Sanders, in hospital, people always talk about these various things that occur that can wipe you out. What are they that people worry about, bacterial or otherwise, in a hospital?
Yeah, so there are a lot of infections that someone could acquire while in the hospital. We call them nosocomial infections. There are infections that you didn't come into the hospital with, but you acquired while you were there.
Sure.
So sometimes after a surgery, a wound can get infected. People get pneumonias sometimes in the hospital. We do a lot of interventions in the hospital, like put intravenous lines in people and catheters in their bladder, and those can be a source of or a conduit for bacteria to get into the body. So the issue with sepsis in the hospital is oftentimes something that's acquired in the hospital, not something that somebody comes in with. So we try our best to limit a person's exposure to intravenous lines only when they need them, catheters in their bladder only when they need them, and we obviously do as good a job as possible in terms of meticulous surgical care and appropriate antibiotics after surgery.
And get them out of the hospital as soon as you can.
And get them out of the hospital as soon as they can, because there are a lot of resistant bacteria that circulate in the hospital setting. A lot of them are getting into the community these days too, but there are a lot of bad bacteria that live in the hospital that are very resistant to the antibiotics we have.
And this has been known, you know, in for a while now. And when I've been in the hospital, people have come in and they wash the walls. So obviously people have to, you know, understand that a hospital can be a dangerous place to be.
Right. And the most important first line, really, guard you have against anything is to wash your hands as much as possible in the hospital before and after contact with every patient.
Now that's the hospital. So let's go back to Al Cardillo. You're the executive vice president of the Home Care Association of New York State. We've been talking about the danger in hospitals. Now talk to us about why the home care people are here today.
Well, it's significantly because 80 to 90% of sepsis cases actually occur in community. And because they are not recognized early, by the time the person is, as I said earlier, is feeling the worst that they probably have ever felt in their life, they show up in the emergency room. You know, through the governor's initiative this year and the initiative of the Staunton Foundation, mm-hmm. the hospitals are now required to have protocols when patients go to the emergency room. And so then they're evaluated and quickly brought into usually an ICU unit where they're, upon diagnosis, they're given antibiotics
and
IV fluids.
I'm sorry, but what happened to Jim Henson? Was he an issue of this? This is the same thing?
Right. Well, he died of a very lethal bacteria, one we are very concerned about. People get it.
Something and that's called
Group A streptococcus. Some people would refer to it, if it's involving the skin, as flesh-eating bacteria. It's a very rapid-killing bacteria. It's probably, I would say, of all the bacteria that I deal with and a lot of my colleagues deal with, it's the greatest concern of any bacteria that infects somebody. It kills very rapidly. He got it into his lungs as a pneumonia, but you can get it most of the time on the skin and cause an overwhelming infection.
Could he have been saved?
The question becomes timing. I see a lot of people who have group A streptococcus bacteremia, meaning in their bloodstream,
yes.
That despite all of our efforts, getting appropriate antibiotics in a timely fashion, the first hour or two after somebody comes into the hospital, after they come into the hospital, that they still cannot be saved. A lot of those infections happen at home, maybe an incidental little skin scrape, like unfortunately Roy Staunton had, and it gets overwhelmed. In the body, and by the time that person arrives at the hospital, it's really too late.
Well, you know, people tell me all the time they don't like to listen to this program because it scares the hell out of them. I'm wondering, you know, I mean, everybody gets scrapes on their arms and stuff like that. So what's the differentiation? How do we know whether it's sepsis or not?
Yeah, you don't want to frighten the general community out there that every time you get a paper cut or you get a mosquito bite or you have even a burn from cooking or anything like that, that's going to end up and evolve into flesh-eating bacteria. It is really a dice roll. It is a lightning bolt that hits people without really consequence or caused by anything that's happened to them in the past. But it is usually an incidental break in the skin that then evolves into a very hot, red, angry cellulitis or skin infection.
Okay.
That's time to get a hold of your doctor ASAP.
Okay, now that is where we're going. So tell me what the symptom is that would make Alan go to the Fairview Emergency Room in Great Barrington.
Good question. So, you know, a skin infection, for example, or if someone has another infection in their body, there'll be some heralding signs of when there may be some concern of impending sepsis. That is, you having shaking chills. You may have a decrease in the urine output in your body, and your urine starts to get quite dark. You may have some mottling or discoloration of your skin, some blanching discoloration in your skin. You may have some changes in the way you think. You may not be making sense to people around you. So your loved ones or caregivers or some friend may be asking you, is everything okay? Because you're not making a lot of sense. So these are some early telltale signs that can happen to people before they ever get to medical attention that would tell them that a skin infection is getting out of control, or a bladder infection is getting out of control, or pneumonia is out of control. But most of those really bad skin infections, like you mentioned, that group A strep, that's a very painful source or site on the person's body. So pain, outside of what it should look like in terms of consequences, something you should worry about.
Okay, just because this is so interesting to me, Al Cardillo, let's talk about the Sepsis Intervention Initiative. So doctor, as we say in the, when we're waiting to see him, has told us what we have to look out for. Is there anything you want to add to that?
Yes. While anyone can get sepsis, as the doctor was saying, it could come from an innocuous scrape, like in the case of Rory Stoughton. The population that is among the most high risk are individuals who are elderly, have disabilities, compromised immune systems, medically fragile children.
Diabetes?
Yes. So typically the kinds of individuals that are in home care or that a home health agency can reach. So as we were researching what we might be able to do to make a contribution toward this very deadly disease, someone dies every 2 minutes in this country of sepsis.
That's a lot of people.
What we did was is that we brought together some of the best experts in the country, and we developed a screening tool and protocol that would in a way translate to what the hospitals are doing. So that every time there's a clinical visit with the elderly or with anybody in the community from a home health nurse, this tool would be applied. The tool would look for anything from the risk factors to the presence of symptoms, as Dr. Sanders
let's
described.
Let's go over those. We have to take a break, but very quickly, let's hear those symptoms the way that you see them.
Well, again, it's either shivering, it's shivering cold, it's a mottling of the skin, it's pain.
Mottling.
Yes.
M-O-T-T.
Yes. It's a level of pain like you've never felt before.
Really?
Just feeling like the worst you've ever felt in your life. Mm. It could be fever, or it could be the chill. So those are some of the typical symptoms that the individual could recognize. We have a clinical protocol that clinicians would follow to look for either risk factors or look for the onset of symptoms, which then the nurse would consult with a physician and a decision would be made about whether to treat the patient, educate the patient, or refer the patient for care.
All very fancy words, but it really comes down to timing, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes, 100%.
You know, you really got to get in fast. Henson might be alive to this day if he had moved faster, right? We're going to take a break. We're going to come right back. We'll go to the inevitable Jim from Matamoros.
Support for WAMC comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, helping fight the epidemic opiate crisis both locally and throughout the country with specialized programs, education, and support for men, women, and families. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture, specializing in Lyme disease. Now accepting new primary care patients, WindhorseNaturopathic.com. Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, announcing new primary care center on Main Street, Fonda, now open, NLH.org. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world, WaldorfSaratoga.org. And from Studio KTM Salon Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color from corrective to fashion by stylist Kristen Marquette, StudioKTM.com.
And we are back, joined by Dr. Sanders, who's president of the Upstate Infectious Diseases Associates in Albany, and Al Cardillo, executive vice president of the Home Association of New York, which is comprised of nearly 300 home care agencies, hospices, and managed long-term care plans. And he's the head of the new Sepsis Intervention Initiative. If this is somewhat scary to you, I don't blame you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
What genus of bacteria are most commonly associated with septicemia? And do probiotics have any apparent effect on septicemia?
Dr. Sanders.
I'll take that. So, Jim, I hate to start the answer with it depends, but it does depend, and it really comes down to where we are. Is it in the hospital, if we were to tally up all our bacteria that we isolate in our laboratory, I would tell you that a staphylococcal infection would be the leading type of bacteria species that would cause bacteria in the bloodstream or sepsis. After that, we would think more commonly would be a gram-negative bacteria like E. coli, which was responsible for the majority of urinary tract infections, would come up second. And then a host of other bacteria would come up in third to fifth or sixth place. But in terms of hospital-acquired infections, staph infections would be up there at number one, and then these other gram-negative rods like E. coli, number two. That's not the case necessarily for everything on the outside. People will oftentimes come to the hospital with a really bad pneumonia, but we'll never really identify the cause of it. But we can consider certain things that would have caused it. They may still get septic, but we can't actually identify the bacteria in the bloodstream. So there's a whole other host of bacteria that can really hurt somebody very, very quickly on the outside, from bladder infections to pneumonia. We may not always isolate them from their bloodstream, but they can still be lethal.
So, let me just say thank you very much to Jim from Matamoros. We'll go now to, Howard in New Paltz. Okay, Howard in New Paltz, you're on.
I'm here. How are you?
Yeah,
can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. You're fine.
Okay, because I got a bad phone here. So, anyway, I noticed over the years that in most hospitals and also buses and probably trains don't have any windows where you can get air to come to flow into the rooms. That, to me, sounds like a test tube full of germs.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I'm not so sure that on journeys, on trains and buses, it's as concerning as someplace like an airplane when you have a lot more people in a concentrated area for a longer period of time. It's pretty common, actually, for people after air travel to get viral infections.
But
because
mostly,
of the...
mostly in hospitals, though. I mean, it's ridiculous. You can't.
Hey, Howard, just, Howard, yeah. Howard, Howard. I'm the moderator. He's the doctor. He's answering the question. Then you can talk. Go ahead.
I'll give a break.
No problem. So, and our hospital windows don't open. I'll be clear about that. And they aren't supposed to. We always worry about dust and dirt from the outside getting into it, which should be an antiseptic environment. So we do have good air exchanges in our rooms, in our hallways, obviously in our operating rooms, to really prevent buildup of bacteria and viruses. So we do our best to actually get a pretty good control over our hospital air quality at all times with certain filters and a lot of air exchanges. So it's not the same as the inside of an airplane or inside of a bus.
Still a dangerous place to be. Howard,
yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Dick in Long Meadow. But first, I'll give you the telephone number. We got, if you want to get on now, this is a good time to get on. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I can guarantee you, you call right this second, you're in. Okay, but that doesn't mean there won't be other people thinking like you're thinking. Okay, so 1-800-348-2551. Dick in Long Meadow. Okay, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is when you look at septicemia now and you looked at it 20 years ago, the fatality rate was a lot more. And what I'm kind of talking about is drugs like aminoglycosides, cephalosporins, and a lot of other drugs that they use now for septicemia. Especially, let's say there was a small piece of surgery, somebody nicked a bowel, there was some spillage, you had septicemia shortly after. Today they survive, even gram-negative sepsis. And I was just wondering if you could comment on some of these products they're using today.
So, you know, our antibiotic armamentarium has grown, but unfortunately it has not grown as quickly as the bacteria have evolved and become more resistant. We have more choices than we did 30 years ago, but the bugs are winning, I would say, in certain ways. Despite new antibiotics in the market, resistance crops up pretty quickly after that new antibiotic comes onto the market and is used in the hospital.
Interesting.
We try as best as possible to preserve those agents that have activity against our most resistant bacteria by doing something called antibiotic stewardship in our hospital. It's a big part of managing sepsis in a lot of ways.
So what does that mean?
So I do it in my hospital at St. Peter's, and my partners do it at Albany Medical Center Hospital, and the hospitals are actually required to do it throughout the country now, whereby infectious disease practitioners and infection control practitioners and pharmacists will actually go and round in the hospital on all people who are on antibiotics for a prolonged period of time, or more exclusive antibiotics, and make sure they're being used for the right reason. And if they're overusing antibiotics, we tell the providers, please de-escalate, get down to a more narrow drug that focuses on the bacteria that's at play. Don't use these big gun agents for extended periods of time, because we're going to lose their power pretty quickly because of resistance. So we actually control antibiotic utilization for what is needed in the hospital.
So that's so interesting. Is there a fear on your part? I mean, after all, the word is infectious, right? Are you afraid you'll get infected?
I'm really not afraid that I'm going to be infected. I take the precautions that all our practitioners, I think, are supposed to be taking on a daily basis, washing your hands before and after every patient. When someone has a resistant bacteria, they're in an isolation room, so we put on a gown, we put gloves. If need, we put a mask on before we get into the room, take them off afterwards. I've been in practice for 23 years and trained for 7 years before that. Knock on wood, I've been exposed to a lot of resistant bacteria, but
it
never comes out with anything. It hasn't happened.
I know a woman who leaves her keys in her car all the time, and she always says to me, somebody I know, and says to me, I've never had the car stolen. And I always say, it only takes once.
Right. Well, I'm not going to admit that I leave my keys in my car, because I do. But
the other question I was curious about was, is vancomycin still effective for some of these problems you encounter?
Yes. So vancomycin is an antibiotic that's been around for 50 years at this point. It's an excellent bacteria. It has lost some of its punch. We use it when we need it. We stop it when it's not supposed to be given, so we're trying to preserve it. It's still a very good drug, but unfortunately, the staph bacteria that we use it for has become increasingly resistant to it, so we have to use different, newer drugs instead of it.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to go, let's see here, to Rob in East Granby, Connecticut. All right, Rob, your turn.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Two quick questions. One is sepsis. Is there another term that they use often? It's for like a flesh-eating disease that's common in hospitals these days.
Yeah, so actually sepsis gets interchangeably used with something called bacteremia or bacteria in the bloodstream. It's the same as septicemia, but not all patients who have sepsis will actually grow bacteria in the blood. Sepsis is a definition of, as Al mentioned before, a body's dysregulated response to any type of infection. You can become septic from influenza, but we're not going to grow influenza out of your bloodstream. So it's the body's response in terms of the organ systems that get affected by the infection. So,
yeah, but I know Rob's question because I was trying to think of the name also. I believe it starts with M, and it's in, you know, people worry about people who go into the hospital because this is an infectious disease, and
I think MRSA maybe?
Yeah, like MRSA infection. That's what it is.
That's MRSA.
Yeah, but it's not really synonymous with sepsis, because MRSA can lead to sepsis. So can a urinary tract infection caused by E. coli. So can a salmonella infection caused by, a foodborne illness. So not all MRSA is sepsis, and not all sepsis is MRSA. But MRSA in the hospital is a very common cause of the picture of sepsis, because the bacteria gets
into the blood. And the reason, if you don't mind, why I was asking is because I think last summer I was bit by either a spider or maybe a tick, but it had on my thigh, and it had turned into a opened wound. I was placed on a very strong antibacterial and a very strong antibiotic for the course, 10 days or whatever it may be. And the doctor says, well, Jesus, looks, like I don't know if you call it sepsis, but it was like it was black. It was necropathy, I believe.
Necrotic.
Necrotic, right.
Yes.
But I mean, it's all healed up since then.
Stop. I want the doctor to take this.
So, Rob, let me just say that most of the time in the Northeast, spiders don't bite. The kind of spider bites people worry about are caused by brown recluse spiders that exist down in the south, central, and southern part of this country. The appearance of a MRSA infection is very similar to a spider bite infection you see in other parts of the country. So a lot of people come in and get misdiagnosed or mislabeled as spider bites. What classically they have is a big necrotic MRSA infection, and it needs to get drained effectively by a surgeon or by an ER doctor and get put on appropriate antibiotics to counter MRSA, as long as it grows from that wound.
And do the ER people know what they're doing usually?
Yeah, they do. They've been really at the forefront of taking care of sepsis in general. They're our biggest allies in treating sepsis early, recognize it and treating it early. But even for things like a MRSA infection, patients may come in saying, look at this terrible spider bite. They have to be countered by the ER doctor who says, that's not a spider bite. That's really a MRSA abscess and we got to drain
it. Interesting. Okay. I want to go to Al Cardillo for just one moment. I don't want to leave you out of this, Al, and ask you this. So when your folks are going around to people's homes and things, you're not doctors, right? But you still have to spread the word.
Well, right. Well, nurses typically are the clinicians which would apply this screen.
Oh, I see. So
this is within their clinical scope of practice, because ordinarily when they go in, they are assessing patients. They're looking at whether or not there are signs of concerns. But this special tool that we created zeroes them right in on the core risk factors and prevalent symptoms of potential sepsis.
Yes, but it sounds like a lot of gobbledygook. What I need is specifics. I mean, what is it that the nurse takes a look at your skin and says, "What?"
No. Well, first, when the nurse and this is on every encounter, when the nurse encounters the patient, the nurse is determining if the patient has the presence of anything that would suggest an infection or a source site of infection. So, let's say the patient has had a history of urinary tract infections,
sure.
Or if the patient has a PICC line, or a urinary catheter. That nurse is going to observe that patient very carefully and then look for any other symptoms which would suggest that there may be a problem brewing. It could be a fever. It could be some confusion, as Dr. Sanders had said. Could be a blood, an issue with the temperature. So any of those, when the right combination of factors is identified on the screen, the nurse then has a consultation with the physician and says, I have a patient. The patient is exhibiting these criteria. Mm. Let's talk about what needs to happen. And sometimes it's the doctor will say, here's what you need to do in the context of the home. Or the doctor will refer the patient to the ER if, in fact, that's what the symptoms suggest.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, let's go to Jake in... Nope, not Jake, not yet. Jamin in North Pownell, Vermont. Okay, Jamin, you're on.
Whoops.
Hello.
That wasn't my radio. Hello. I lost you there for a second.
By the way, the rules are, Jamin, just so everybody realizes the rules. The rules are you can't listen to the radio. You got to stay with your phone because there's a distance.
That's what I'm doing. Radio is off.
Excellent. You
it's
win.
It's in arm's reach. I've already been instructed to shut it off.
Okay, great.
Okay, doctor. I'm seeking a little information on a disease that I have right now. It took 4 months to get the diagnosis, but... I've been having recent problems with my legs. They'll hold me up for about 200 feet on level ground, and then I'm on a walker so I can sit down for 5 minutes or so. So I've got babesiosis. It's one of the new tick-borne diseases. After I had my fourth case of Lyme, which was diagnosed recently, too, I went back up and they drew four vials of blood to test for 10 diseases, tick-borne.
Okay, so they found... Okay, wait. So they found the babesiosis. We'll go with the doctor now. Doctor?
So, thanks for the...
I called my... I don't have transportation. I could get public transportation. But instead of calling them first, my doctor called me and told me I had babesiosis and had my wife pick up at a local pharmacy the prescriptions. Well, one they had in stock, that would have been...
Jamin, you got to hurry because there are a lot of people on the phone waiting here. Okay, so what is the... Whoa. Listen, I'll hang up in a minute. What is the specific question you have? What's your specific question?
Do you have any further treatment recommended that I should follow?
Okay.
So thanks for the question, Jamie. So I don't want to provide you medical advice over the radio right now as a patient who I'm not examining. So tick-borne infections are an important part of our concern for sepsis.
I'll call my primary care doctor. I'll get off the air now.
No, stay on the air. We may want to ask you a question, but it's important that you let the doctor finish his thought. Okay, go ahead.
Thanks. So the tick-borne infections are a concern for us in terms of the potential presentation for sepsis. Now, you mentioned babesiosis, which is essentially a malaria-like infection that exists in North America.
Exactly.
And it is spread by...
Whoa, Jamin, I just told you what the rules are. You got to let the doctor talk. Go ahead.
So it is transmitted by ticks, and it causes an infection in red blood cells just like malaria. People who have underlying immune problems, like not having a spleen because it's been removed, or they're immunosuppressed because of things like AIDS or medications, can get terribly, terribly sick with this kind of infection, and it can lead to death. Now, in most of the population, this infection, babesiosis, doesn't cause a great deal of problems, and we get through it sometimes without even giving anybody antibiotics, and no one even knew they had it. But in the general population of people who don't have those immune problems, we treat it effectively with 7 to 10 days of antibiotics, and they are cured. There is no chronic phase of babesiosis. So I would just tell you that you can check back with your primary care doctor, but we get through that infection in the hospital in the outpatient setting with an appropriate course of antibiotics without any sequelae. Likewise, another tick-borne infection called anaplasmosis, also spread by ticks, can cause an overwhelming infection, can cause sepsis, can actually kill people. But again, it's rapidly diagnosed in the hospital. We get people on antibiotics quickly. They turn around very rapidly, and those who are getting appropriate medical attention get better in 7 to 10 days also. There is no chronic phase or debility after those two tick-borne infections in general.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Jamin. We are now going to take a short break, and we will be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Bariatric Program at Adirondack Health, Saranac Lake. Offering weight loss, surgery, and lifestyle education, better health, better lives, adirondackhealth.org. New York Oncology Hematology, providing second opinions, immunotherapy, and clinical research trials for cancer patients. 31 physicians, 7 locations, newyorkoncology.com. Act Smart New York, Saratoga Springs, offering individualized outpatient counseling and Suboxone treatment for opiate use disorder and medical treatments for alcohol problems. Act Smart, newyork.com. From Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. And from Daughters of Sarah Albany, New York, featuring assisted living and respite care at the Masry Residence, friends, family, community, 518-689-0453 for tours and information.
And we are back with Dr. Sanders, who is president of the Upstate Infectious Disease Associates in Albany, and Al Cardillo, vice president of the Home Care Association of New York State. Okay, so we've got a lot of people on the phones, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to the guy who's on the line the longest, and that happens to be Jake in Albany. Jake in Albany, you're on. Go.
Hey, Alan, I'm a huge fan. I just have a quick question for the doctor. I read an article years ago that said that the copper on the most used surfaces of the hospital has a natural alkalizing effect and cut down on the numbers of bacteria on the surface. So, for instance, they do handrails, TV remotes, and things like that. Now, for people who need to be quarantined, why wouldn't you have hospitals that are like that? Is it just a cost issue?
Well, that's a good question. Copper is expensive, but we actually use copper in our hospital water supply systems to actually superheat our water with copper coils to kill something called Legionella, which is a life-threatening bacteria that is spread around in water supplies. It comes out of shower heads in the hospital. It comes out of faucets in the hospital. And we have problems with Legionella in the hospital. We do actually have copper coils in our heating systems for the hot water and superheat the water with copper. But we don't have copper on high-touch areas like handrails or in the patient rooms on the bed rails and stuff like that, which are usually made of some plastic material. Silver is also actually a pretty good agent. We use it not only as an application on wounds sometimes because it kills bacteria, but silver is oftentimes even put on a lining on top of these intravenous catheters to prevent bacteria from adhering onto the catheter and serving as a chemical kill agent for bacteria. But other than that, we don't have copper in our hospitals in a general way.
Thank you, Jake. Okay, and now we're going to go to Christine in Phoenicia. Christine, you're on.
Hi, guys. I was wondering, do you think in this at this point in time that people would be better served to be wearing masks with all the airborne diseases that are floating through the air these days?
Well, if you, it's a good question. In other countries, there's a lot of folks you see wearing cotton masks or masks on subways and buses, on mass transit. It happens a lot more overseas than we ever see it here. I would tell you in our hospitals, we demand that practitioners wear masks when walking into a room if someone has an airborne kind of infection, something that's spread in the air by a droplet, by a sneeze, like influenza, and other things. On a rare occasion, we have measles or mumps in the hospital. Mm. We have to wear a mask for that. But I don't think you're getting a lot of gain by wearing a mask out in the shopping mall or on a bus around Albany. Or
okay, that's
area.
My question.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think you gain much from that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. Let's see, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I will go to Julie in Utica. Okay, Julie, you're on.
Hi, guys. Your screen said it might not apply, but here goes. In 2012, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and I was two doctors suggested mercaptopurine, which led me to be in the hospital with full sepsis. I almost died. And so I kind of lost my faith in gastroenterology for a while, so I went on to something else that didn't lower your immune system. And then I moved here to Utica, and then this doctor gave me an enzyme test. Long story short, he suggested mercaptopurine. I got sick from it again. So now my Crohn's has worsened, and now they want to put me on Humira, which he says is a completely different drug, and I get that, but it's supposed to lower your immune system. So I'm wondering if his comforting words are something I should consider with suspects. So, would you give any advice on that?
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So, Julie, I'm sorry about your underlying illness, because Crohn's is for many people, it's a lifelong battle. It's a chronic inflammation in your bowel that is really not a curable disease per se, but it can be suppressed. And a lot of people gain a great deal of help and benefit from some of these newer agents that have been put on the pharmaceutical market, like Humira, that really try to suppress your immune system in a way different than the other drug you were talking about. But it's a very delicate balance. For all the benefit that you can get from an immune drug like that, there are significant problems you can get in terms of being exposed to any type of infection and fungal infections, tuberculosis that can overwhelm your body. So you have to weigh the benefits and the risk of these kinds of things. And I'm not going to give you advice about Humira because I don't prescribe that, but I do see people who do get affected by infections because they're on agents like this, and they may get benefit from it, or they often get benefit for their inflammatory bowel disease, but it puts their body at risk because now they have to be considered to be an immunosuppressed patient. Al spoke about it before. Those nurses and the patients who are being seen on an outpatient basis, they should be screened for infections in that case.
Al Cardillo?
Yes, and the comment also raises another, I think, very important issue with respect to sepsis. Very often, those that survive sepsis have some very, very long-term or very serious impairment, even once they leave the hospital. They may have an organ that doesn't function properly anymore. Many people who are discharged with sepsis end up as either double or even quadruple amputees because of the nature of the course of the condition, which causes the tissues in the extremities to actually die. So one of the things that
aren't you all glad you're listening today? Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things that especially heightens the importance of early recognition and screening, but also on the far end when bringing patients home from the hospital that have had this condition, which home health agencies do very frequently. recently, it's very important to support individuals in a very broad way. And there are discussions both in New York and nationally about how best to support individuals who've come home with sepsis.
Okay, Julie, thank you. And we'll go to Peter in West Warren, Massachusetts. 1-800-348-2551. Go, Peter.
Hello. I had a friend who had a UTI that had turned into sepsis. And
okay, wait. UTI is?
Urinary tract infection.
Okay. We try not to use, those things.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And it dropped the blood pressure down by half, and I was wondering why that happened.
That's a great question, Peter. So the body has a lot of reactions to infections, and one of them can be low blood pressure. And oftentimes bacteria that you mentioned already, a urinary tract infection, things that are caused by gram-negative rods or E. coli, there are chemicals that live on the outside wall of these bacteria that are released during an infection and circulate in the body. And actually, they're called endotoxins. And what they actually do is they cause the blood pressure in the body to drop precipitously. The body is, in the setting of, as we talked before about sepsis, and it's an overwhelming, unregulated response to infection. And one of the biggest contributors to organ failure and sometimes organ death is that the blood pressure to the vital organs like the kidneys or their lungs gets so low that those organs no longer function appropriately. The body's preference is to get blood as a pressure head up to the things like your brain and your heart, the two most important organs in your body, and sometimes at the expense of things like your lungs and your kidneys. So the bacteria release these chemicals that are almost like poisons, they're toxins, and it causes your blood pressure to drop precipitously, and those organs can then die off. When people come to the hospital for treatment of sepsis, one of the first things we do at time zero, get an IV line in them, put tons of IV fluids into them. If they don't respond to the IV fluids, we give them actually medications just like adrenaline, epinephrine they put into their body to get their blood pressure up.
Thank you very much, Peter. Okay, now we're going to go to Sean in Liberty. Okay, Sean, you're on.
Hi, doctors. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. You guys touched on MRSA, but in the hospitals are testing, you know, in the nose. And I was curious, when they test for MRSA positive in the nose, I guess it's a two-part question. Is it always present after that test? And then if it is, what are the long-term, health problems with that?
So that's a good question. There's not really any long-term health consequences of having been screened for MRSA and they find it in your nose. It's a convenient place to look for bacteria because it's an opening to the outside world. And it's convenient. It's right there. It's an orifice. So when we find MRSA in the nose, it would oftentimes lead us to be concerned that MRSA may be the cause of something like a pneumonia if you have it coincidentally, or people are going for open heart surgery or having a new hip or a knee put in them, an artificial device, a pacemaker put in. We will screen the patient first by doing a swab looking for MRSA, and if that patient is colonized, meaning that they have MRSA on their skin or in their nose, it gives the surgeons a good head start into what antibiotic to give them as a prophylactic for the surgery. So we'll give them a separate reserved antibiotic if they have MRSA on their skin or in their nose. But we don't bring people in the hospital and test everybody for MRSA to see if they have it in their nose for any particular reason other than a preemptive.
Thank you, Sean. Okay, let's go to Karen in Clifton Park. Okay, Karen, your turn.
Okay, quick question. My husband was in the hospital, and I'm worried about MRSA because my mother had terrible MRSA. The tech that was doing the EKG had gloves on, but she had on very dangly jewelry that was dangling all over his chest. Is that anything to be concerned about?
I mean, you know,
I said it was an issue, and everybody acted like I was losing my mind.
So you weren't losing your mind. You were concerned about your husband for good reasons, and I would tell you that we can't ensure that all, you know, jewelry is sterile in the hospital. I think it's a good idea for technicians not to wear bracelets. We actually don't allow nurses to wear artificial fingernails any longer in the hospital because they can harbor bacteria. underneath those fingernails, and that's a high touch area of the hands. So MRSA can easily exist on the cuff of our white, beautiful, clean hospital gowns and coats that we wear in the hospital. It's omnipresent in the hospital, and we just have to do a very good job of hand washing before and after, using, you know, appropriate clean scrubs, clean white laboratory coats. And a bracelet could harbor MRSA, no question about it. But at the same time, people come in the hospital and already have MRSA on them, on their skin, or even in their nose. We don't know all these people at the outset.
Thank you, Karen. All right, now we're going to go to Linda in Salem. Okay, Linda in Salem, you're on.
Hello. I'd like to ask about the role of antibiotics in animal agriculture. I've heard that 80% of antibiotics consumed in America are used for that purpose. And I just wondered, is that causing a lot of antibiotic resistance?
So that's a great question. And I would, concur with your concern, because it's real. We know for a long time, over the last probably two or three decades, that antibiotics that are used in agriculture, notably in the chicken and beef industries, clearly to keep the animals from getting infections and grow faster and get them to market faster, those animals will develop resistant bacteria in their bodies, on their flesh. And that resistant bacteria will spread into our food supply. There's no question about it that certain bacteria that are resistant in humans these days have come to us because of the overuse of antibiotics in the food and food industry.
So, doctor, when we find we go to the butcher, we really want to ask for animals that have not been treated, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. So I think it's an appropriate way. If you're going to eat meat, And I'm not advocating one way or the other for that. I think it'd be.
Do you?
I do. Yeah. But I think knowing where that meat is, you know, how it's been raised, and if antibiotics have been used in the grain, is an important question.
Linda, thank you. Okay, let's go to now Doris in Cornwall. Doris in Cornwall, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. My grandfather was in the hospital after a car accident, and he had a catheter, and he, after a while, he ended up getting sepsis, and he was treated for it, but my question is, he now has Alzheimer's, and I was wondering if the sepsis might have had anything to do with that.
So that's a good question. Let me just start off, Doris, by telling you that we've had an initiative for the last 3 years at St. Peter's Hospital, where I work, where we actually, the infectious disease doctors and the infection control practitioners, walk the halls three times a week and round on patients who have catheters in their bladder and catheters in their bloodstream, and make sure that they are indicated with 100% assuredness. And if they're not, we demand that the nurses and the providers make every effort to take those catheters out to limit the chance of a catheter-associated urinary tract infection or a catheter-associated bloodstream infection. Now, to your point about Alzheimer's and dementia, now, anytime somebody has sepsis, that can always lead to a drop in their blood pressure, as I mentioned to you before. And sometimes people go through the rigors of having an awful infection in the hospital, and they can be left with deterioration in kidney function, deterioration in lung function. It could affect, as Al said before, perfusion to their skin and their digits, and they can get loss of digits. Likewise,
digits meaning hands.
The fingers and the hands and the toes. But sometimes people can have a perfusion problem to the brain. Now, I can't tell you it accelerates dementia or causes dementia, but any impact, especially sepsis, in an elderly person who is at risk for, things like at baseline having mental status problems already and having dementia, it is not going to help them. And they could actually be left with a more accelerated form of their neurologic deficit.
All right. Thank you very much for that. All right. And now over to Mary in Albany, and we're running out of time here, Mary, so make it quick.
Hi. I didn't actually have a question, but I just had a comment to make to Dr. Sanders. I was a patient of yours back in February 2001, and I had the necrotizing fasciitis, And basically, you saved my life with a diagnosis.
See?
And I was in intensive care. Yeah.
That's
Dr.
wonderful.
Sanders.
Well, Mary, I see people outside the hospital. It warms my heart. And thank you very much for mentioning that. And you know what? I would tell you, Mary, of any infectious disease that I get incredible pleasure and pride out of taking care of, it is people who have that kind of infection, necrotizing fasciitis, and were able to make a really major impact on their life. But
and
thanks.
Thank you, Mary. That's a wonderful story. Appreciate that. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. I do apologize to Martin in Cohoes, who we left on the air, who wanted to know about antibiotic-resistant bacteria and how they become that way. One-sentence answer, Doc?
So they become that way because of being exposed to too much antibiotics over a period of time,
right,
and the bacteria outwit the antibiotic.
Are we winning the race? Are we winning the race?
We are not winning the race.
We're losing the race.
Yes.
Okay. And so, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. We're out of time. I want to thank Dr. Alan Sanders and Al Cardillo for being with us today. Support for the Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers Jim Lavoulis and I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, if you love this program, and many people say that they do, the lockbox is open. We can't have the station without your help. So WAMC.org or 1-800-323-9262 is the way to get in on it. Stay tuned now for a news update.